Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
Off the ball. Rugby.
I think he'd probably break my heart next Saturday, beating Munster fellas around Croke Park and trying to be on a dominant Leinster side. We'll see, obviously, about that.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Rugby on Off the Ball.
With Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.
Now then, Rebuilding a Man by Fergus Farrell is a brand new book which is absolutely amazing. The subheading of it is My Battle to Remake My Body and My Life and Become the Man I Was Meant to Be. Fergus Farrell, you're welcome to studio. I presume it's hard to put too fine a point on what exactly your story encapsulates.
There isn't any one thing that kind of, obviously there is, you know, the accident and maybe the role that kind of might stand out, but there's a lot of stuff in between it that, brings me here today.
Yeah, and a lot of stuff that most of us wouldn't have realised as well. I think we spoke to you a few times around the row, and I don't think we've ever really spoken to you about your own story too much prior to that. Was it challenging putting that out into the public?
Yeah. When you put all out there on paper, you can't take it back. You can't hide anymore. So for me, it was a very emotional thing to do. Now, as I went through it, though, I absolutely learned so much about myself as well. And I suppose that was great because it's something that I've tried to instill in myself, is that every day is a day to learn and improve. And so when I was going through this process of writing the book and putting it on paper, I started seeing patterns about myself and different things, you know. I was going, wow, I never realised that. So it has been a joy, but it was difficult.
If we go back to the start of your life, I mean, we are a sports show here. We don't always stick to just sport, but sport is a massive part of your life. How big a part of your identity was the rugby player or the soccer player, Fergus Farrell?
It was everything for me, like as a young boy and as a man growing up, you know, because I lived in a town, Athenry. That's my town. And when I was growing up, the hurling was so strong there. And I had a lot of mates who went on and played for Athenry Club when they were in All-Ireland Club, you know, titles. But I chose a totally different avenue. And obviously that was my rugby avenue. And I wanted to represent rugby as good as I could to say, well, look at, yeah, hurling is absolutely fantastic sport, but there's also this rugby game and I'm going to be as good as I can be in my rugby field as you are as in your hurling field. As I revert back to the book, like that was me creating a challenge internally that I would never vocalise with, you know, my mates who were playing the hurling. But I had an insight and saying, hey, look at, all right, fair play to you. You're representing your town, and the club. But I'm going to do the same for Munavé, and I'm going to do it as best as my abilities.
A bit of a chip on your shoulder.
Yeah. Pretty much, I think so. Yeah.
And when you realise you're a good rugby player, at what point does that come? Like, and why is that? Is it because you've got a bit of aggression about you? You've got a bit of physicality about you, a bit of size about you.
Well, there's a bit of all that in it, you know. But like. Like, how good was I? I wasn't amazing. I just knew how to work hard, put the head down, and I knew how to run a straight line.
Yeah.
I didn't have the skill sets for hurling. I would have loved to have played hurling, but I didn't have those skill sets. So rugby was the game for me. I was ideally suited to it. You know, I was a big, strong young lad. When did I realise I could go a little bit further? I suppose I was probably 15 or 16. I'd actually given up the game of rugby for a few years to play soccer because I absolutely loved soccer.
You were a goalkeeper.
Yeah.
Keeping David Ford out of teams.
It's nuts, isn't it? Now that was at under 17, under 18 levels. You know, it's a bit nuts. Like, you know, and I'll be honest with you, I didn't really care about, you know, I preferred the community of the rugby. I preferred the respect, the determination, the dedication that you had to give to it. I just preferred the whole, everything, the ethos of the whole sport over soccer. But I actually loved playing the game of soccer, you know. And also, it had soccer got me a lot fitter. Because, you know, you're doing a lot, you're moving on your feet all the time. There was that, you know, turning of pace and all that type of stuff, even as a goalkeeper. So the two of them really worked well together. But yeah, you know, so sport just came ingrained in me.
Yeah, yeah. And to be fair, you were earning money. You were earning £400 sterling a week playing for Galwegian. So yeah. It was a big part.
Per game.
Yeah. So what, 10, 12 games a year? So
Yeah.
Which, to be fair, at this point in history is actually a pretty good wedge of money.
Yeah, like, and I was like 18 and a half, maybe 19, no, 18 and a half, and next minute you're earning this, and they're going, oh man, this is exactly what I want to do.
Yeah.
You know, because at the same time, like, we didn't have to follow training schedules. All we had to do was train 2 or 3 days a week and go to the gym in our own skin. So there wasn't that, you know, academies or anything like that. It was just like, you know, turn up on a Tuesday, turn up on a Thursday, play a match on a Saturday, and then go on the beer.
Yes.
So it was a perfect fit for me.
Was it always the transportation company running a line to this, or did you move around to a couple of different gigs?
No. So my dad was a farmer, but he sold fruit and veg in stalls around Galway City and County, and that's why I was brought up to. But he, when I got the opportunity to go to South Africa through one of A Links, my dad actually ended up selling, or getting out of the fruit and veg business, and he went into doing taxiing. And that was around the 18 and a half, 19 years old mark. And at that stage, then he continued that on, and I was, you know, trying to become more of a rugby player with Galwegian and different things like that. And ultimately, at the age of about 23, I'd say, you know, rugby wasn't going to be for me anymore.
Okay.
You know, I wasn't, I believe I wasn't getting the breaks, but maybe that was because I wasn't representing myself at the best possible way.
You know, how do you mean?
Well, I think for myself, I reacted in the wrong way to knocks. You know, I get an injury, instead of, you know, putting all my energy into recovering from an injury, I go down the other route and I go beer. You know,
Was that laziness? Was that just frustration?
I think it could have been weak mentality.
Weak mentality.
Because you know, you play with a small club like Galway, from one of A,
yes,
a junior club, and I'm going through the ranks of that, and I'm like the best player. Well, I'm not going to say even the best player, but I was getting, you know, representatives and all this type of stuff, and I got to put on the green jersey of Ireland, and I think I thought it was always going to be that way. So when things didn't materialise that way, I don't think I had the ammunition to say, or the mentorship, to say, hold on a sec now, do this and go again and whatever else. See, I thought I should have been starting tight head prop, you know, at the age of 19 for Galwegians, yet there was like Irish internationals in front of me.
And who were the internationals around that era?
We had Peter Bracken, you obviously, Dan McFarland was the other prop, Jerry Flannery was in the squad, like you had Johnny O'Connor, Damien Brown, Mark McConnell, Gavin Duffy, Eric Elwood, Matt Mawson, Pat Dynan, Willie Rowan, Nigel Carlin, and so on and so on. But I was here thinking, there was another guy, Andrew Kershaw, who I was an amazing fan of, and I was twice as fit as him, and I always thought I should be ahead of him, but I wasn't getting the opportunity. And so I think that mindset was, well, I'm here training like mad, but I'm not getting the game time. So when something happened, I just said, nah, I'm sick of this.
Yeah.
You know?
So you throw yourself into your work life, really, as much as anything. And you can tell from reading your story that goes pretty supernova pretty quickly. The business goes very well, and you invest, and you try to expand all the time.
Yeah, yeah. And again, that was in my DNA, you know, I want to be the best, what I can be and what's in my control. So I was never happy just having 2, 3, 4, 5 buses. I wanted more.
This is a coach company, basically.
Yeah, and coach company, yeah. And I just wanted to be, but it wasn't even just to have X amount of coaches in the air, X amount of employees. I want to have the nicest fleet, the newest fleet, so I could go out and get the nice big contracts and be that big operator within Ireland, you know?
You were dealing with big contracts.
Yeah. Massive. Yeah, for me, they were massive contracts.
Over £1 million in some cases.
Exactly, yeah. Per annum.
Yeah.
1.2, 1.3 million contracts per annum. And I steered my business away from... So what built my business was multiple customers and... treating every customer the exact same and so on and so on. But then I started to change that business model into, you know, going for the larger contracts and having a fewer customers. And being honest, you're kind of forgetting about the customers that helped me build up to that point.
Okay.
And that's where I started to make mistakes.
You were completely obsessed with it well.
Yeah.
Talk to us about the mistakes, first of all.
Well, ultimately, the mistakes was I started... going for the bigger contracts, which meant then I needed the fresher fleets, which meant I needed more finance, I needed more overheads to get these big contracts.
What went wrong? Was it? Are we talking crash time here? Or no, it's much.
No, no. Actually, my business was. I actually went through crash time and absolutely.
You were fine,
yeah, because I hadn't massive finances out at the time. I was only starting really in my bus world, and that crash came, and a lot of coach companies suffered. And then when things started improving, I was one of the few bus companies that could actually finance new buses. So at that stage, I was in a place where I could go and get the better work, the better contracts. Now I had the fresher vehicles where everybody else couldn't afford to get the fresher vehicles.
Yeah.
And with that, then I started driving on the business. And throughout that time in the crash, I started looking at different... I started looking at the industry, and I knew if I... Like, there was all 53-seater buses. Now, this is very boring for people who are not in the bus industry, but there's all, you know, there's a kind of 33-seater bus market, and there's a 53-seat bus market. And I was here going, well, everybody has those, and they're struggling. And they're, so they're going to be just chasing all the business out there and a loss-making. So I just started looking at what wasn't in the market. Team coaches, which were huge over in the UK for junior Man United, Liverpool's, you know, the coaches with tables and and like trains inside. And I just said, okay, let me have a look at those. So I ended up going back to the UK and buying a few of those, and I branded up a coach for Connacht.
Yes.
And that was absolutely, to this day, it was my favourite bus ever to drive and obviously to be in. It's crazy to talk about buses in a sports show, but otherwise.
But the thing, the point I'm trying to get to here is that this became a complete obsession for you.
Yeah, it did. It consumed your life. Yeah. I'd be at home at 10 o'clock at night looking at bus magazines. I know. Whereas, you know, a few years ago it would have been rugby magazines, soccer magazines, watching soccer, rugby. Now I was looking at, you know, that's kind of, I suppose, my how I do things. I consume things.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger fuel centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
You know,
I just wanted to establish that because it's important to kind of give a sense of who you were before the accident.
Yeah.
And I think your work, which was quite a sort of open your feet, moving around the place, driving trucks around the country into different countries around the continent. Mm. This was who you were, a massive part of who you were. Mm. Then the accident happens.
Yeah.
Talk to us about that day.
Yeah, so I do you know something? What's funny is I never find it hard talking about what happened.
Okay.
I find it hard talking about what happened afterwards.
Yes.
So on that day, it was a Friday. I was actually about to drive Munavale Rugby Football Club, my club, that I played for many years, to Belfast to play an All-Ireland quarterfinal. And I was really looking forward to it because, you know, I could drive to Belfast and I'd have a few pints with the lads that night, not the players, but you know, the some of the coaching staff, whatever else. And the next day I watch a game and I drive home. Like, that was my little break. And it was Friday, nothing different. I was around the yard doing a few things, and Sean Sorrell, who was a mechanic of mine, had come and was buying I think it was a compressor off me. And but there was a lot of pushing and dragging, in the morning. And then I went in and I left him alone to, because I had to go in and put on my bus driving outfit, white shirt, black pants, tie, which my house was next door. And I came around and he was still there. And while he was there, I just noticed this rustic bench. And I said, do you know something? Somebody's going to reverse into that at night and cause a lot of damage to one of my vehicles, which would cost thousands, but also cause me a lot of grief on the phone when I'm up in Belfast trying to arrange things and swap things around. Whatever. So I said, let's move the bench. And I asked Sean to come over and picked up the bench. I picked it up from my body. And we walked like halfway into the yard, maybe 15, 20 steps, wherever it might have been. And next thing I got this arm muscle bolt up through my back. And I just dropped the bench. And I like that. Like I went down my hunk, you know, and down my two knees like that. And I remember looking at the ground and just going, this is a pain I hadn't felt before. Like, obviously, I'd broken both, you know, I'd ligament damage done at this stage. I'd cruciate damage done. You know, I was fairly accustomed to pain. And I took in 15, 20 deep breaths and then I stood up and I said to Sean, come on, let's move this bench. Because it was definitely in the way now. And I picked it up, took one step and bang. It was like somebody put a shotgun to my back and pulled the trigger. Massive explosion in my back. And maybe sports people might be able to understand this. I don't know when you hear that, when you feel that pop of your cruciate ligament going in your knee, in the back of the knee, it was like that, but multiple. It was a pump, pop. And I remember just falling to the ground. I mean, roaring in pain. Roaring. And I couldn't control that roaring. And eventually, I could gather my thoughts and I realised that this bench was still on top of me, but I couldn't actually feel it. And then I realised that my legs were under me and I couldn't move them. And then in between it all, I started, trying to pull the legs from underneath me or touch them. And then I realised I couldn't feel myself touching them. I could see myself touching them, but I couldn't feel it. And then I was just like completely lonely. And then I had this belt on me. Like I have a belt on me now. I felt like it was melting into my skin. Like, what a weird sensation. And all I could think was, maybe I get this belt off me, the pain will stop, because the pain was just immense. And eventually I got that belt off me. It took me a long time because, I wasn't able to move my legs. I wasn't able to move my upper body neither. I got it off and then the surge of pain just went through my legs. It was like my whole lower body was just on fire. It was like plastic melting in my whole lower body. And I could just continue like that. And like, there wasn't a scratch on the outside of me. Not a scratch. And poor old Sean was looking down on me going, what's after it happened here?
How soon after that moment, because I know you got taken in an ambulance over to Dublin to the Mater Hospital, an airlift option wasn't available at that point. No. How soon after? Is it that day? Is it in the days afterwards that you realise you were in life-changing territory here?
Well, on the way to Dublin, it was horrific. And that journey, I had in my mind that I'm in serious trouble here, but also had in my mind that, okay, get the operation done and that I'll start recovering. I'll come out the far side. I'll be better in some way or format. But I remember waking up after the operation. It was around 9 hours. And it's just like the movies. It's like, I was coming in out of consciousness. You see people after an accident or something coming in out of consciousness. I remember seeing these 2 feet in front of me and I started being able to focus on them a little bit more and more. But as I was focused on them, next minute, this wave of pain started coming over me again. I was like, oh man, this is not good. And that pain just started still increasing, even though I was medicated up to the last, like I was morphing out through the mouth, and then I just tried to figure out these feet that were attached to me, but I couldn't figure out what, they just didn't feel they belonged to me. And the frame, this mirror window right in front of me perfectly, and I was running around, they were just falling out. And then I just couldn't connect with them, couldn't move them, couldn't instruct them to do anything. Very hard sensation to try to explain. But then I went to try and see, could I feel my quads? And then that's when I realised, I looked down and I had, I was catheterised and I had a nappy on me. And at that stage I went, excuse my language, sorry. I'm worse. Because at least before the accident, I didn't think I thought I had my bowels and bladder. So that's something I obviously had thought about. And, and at that stage then, I went into a very dark place. But then my parents and my ex-wife came in to me And at that stage, then the next day is when I actually found out what had happened to me. And that's when I told, you know, the stats, and that was, you know, grade A spinal cord injury. I had a rupture by T9, T10. And the T10 had went through my spinal cord and severed by 90%. And that ultimately, you know, grade A spinal cord injury, paralyzed for life. Yeah.
You said a moment ago with regards to your rugby career that when you got injured, you had a bad mentality about it.
Yeah.
When I read the book, you say that you wanted to become the most positive spinal cord injury patient the matter had ever seen.
Yeah.
Why the different mentality at that point?
It was sink or swim. I had no option. There was no option.
So you are a positive person naturally. That was within you. You just never discovered that in your rugby career.
Yeah. Oh, I'm a very positive person. Yeah. Yeah. Always very positive. Yeah. But I had choices.
Whereas this was pretty black or white, no choice. This is me back on my feet.
Yeah. It's the only option I had.
What does that involve, being the most positive spinal cord patient the matter's ever seen?
Well, for me, it was, not giving up. Simple as. And using every tool I had in my box to make myself stay focused, stay driven. And how did I do that is, ultimately, I knew I had two tools in my box. One was obviously hard work, which I'd always had as a young boy, as my parents instilled in me very young. And the second one was I used visualization all through my life. And I use it to this day, and the smallest little things and everything I do in my life is all around. I visualize first. I'm not a person who can learn that well from reading and stuff like that. If I read something, I might have to read instructions two or three times. But if I see it, I have it.
Okay.
You know, that's just who I am. So I started using the visualization, and the visualization I'd used many years ago. I'd used it when I wanted to play rugby for Ireland. I visualized myself with that green jersey on. I visualized that these are the big things. When I wanted to own a new big bus, I visualized about that. But there's always things about I could impact. I never visualized about, running the mile or the 3 minutes or anything like that. You know, stuff that's impossible.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's what I turned to. I used those things. I knew if I could keep my mind occupied and off everything that was going on, that was easier to stay positive. And so by having those two, hard work and visualization, I just solely focused on those two things. And by doing that, it gave me a purpose, it gave me a challenge, it gave me something to do to occupy that mind and not let that mind run away itself. And that's how I started with it.
Yeah, and the challenges were very clearly laid out for you when you get moved to the National Rehabilitation Hospital. That feels like an environment you really thrived in, Fergus. Like you talked to us about in the book, that is about the ecosystem of the NRH, and how if you're in a bed close to the entrance, you're in big trouble. If you're in a bed far away from the entrance, there might be
you're
on the right road.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas you were positioned away from it, a good bit away from the entrance. There was almost a hierarchy in that hospital, and I kind of felt that you were top of the food chain or close to it.
Yeah, like, look, when I went into that hospital, I was in the flat of my back and I was moving a few toes and maybe being able to lift my knee off the bed is better, you know.
Which were big moments for you to be able to do in the first place.
Oh, huge, yeah. Like, when you're told you'll never do it again, you know, and to be doing it, you're like going, every little gain was like, because at the end of the day, they still were never telling me, you know, it was still being kind of, I don't want to say knocked down, but they were still kind of trying to, you know,
subdue your expectations.
Exactly, yeah, in case I was setting myself up for a fail. So every game was like, I used to celebrate, and this is something that I used to celebrate my gains, because, you know, I don't know, I wasn't kind to myself or something. I don't know why, but now I was kind of, do you know something, this is a huge moment, I'm going to celebrate. I'm celebrating as in or chocolate, because that's all you could do in dinner. Do you know what I mean? Or on Thursday night, we go down and have the few pints by going down to Baker's Corner.
Surreptitiously,
Yeah. We skipped down.
Nobody
seen a line of people in wheelchairs go down the road. Like, it is what you let yourself think. But you're right when I said about dinner H, like, inside in the place, I was left to my own devices to a certain degree as well. And when I was left that, I just went about like creating an environment in there that suited me and my mentality to get the best out of me. I always took the hardest option. always. I had this thing in my mind. And why I started doing that is I always remember Mick, who was one of the care assistants, absolutely fantastic man. And I'd only been there a few days and I was in the wheelchair and my shoe had fallen off my foot. And again, I didn't realise the shoe had fallen off my foot because when you don't have feelings, you don't realise these things. And it was on the ground and he picked it up and he kind of started putting it on, you know. I asked him to help me more and he did help me the first time. And as he was helping me, he looked up and he said, "This is a rehabilitation hospital, not a care home." As in, you could have done this yourself if you tried harder. Mm. So from that moment on, I just said, "Do you know something? He's right. I'm going to push myself. I'm going to make everything as hard as possible because I know if I do it in the hard way, it's going to be the length of time to get improvements shorter." That's yes. What was my head. And ultimately, I set about setting challenges. Like I remember Slav, a lovely man. But when I seen him first, and I was in the flat of my back, and he was flying around the ward in a wheelchair, and I was just saying, he's one obnoxious, yeah. You know. And I was here going, but I said to myself, I ain't going to be faster than that lad. I'm going to be better than that lad. So again, it was about me setting a challenge and creating internal competition. Nobody ever knew that,
yeah.
You know. And then I was so lucky. I had a guy, Declan Nocton, a lovely man, who unfortunately had a very bad accident. He was paraplegic. But I was lucky enough, again, I used to have the same physio slot with him because the physio room is a big, massive open space where everybody goes to do physio at different times. But my slot was at the same time as him. I always remember this man. And even before I really knew him, I was always looking at him going, look at the fight that's in this man's... you know, in them to do this, what we would deem as, even for me, because I had the use of my hands, so I could do everything. And I used his drive as my inspiration to drive myself on. I said, if he can work that hard, you know, to improve himself by that much, I can work just as hard to drive myself on. So again, I was just creating all these things inside in the place, keep me focused and driven on what I had to do. I was there to do a job.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there. Now I made great friends and, you know, and it was people with who we spoke about, peers, but just were there just, I had that thing with, I'm there for a job.
Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18+ in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointsTC.
The physical aspect of things, the rehabilitation piece,
yeah,
feels like the thing that you were best at, and you found that relatively easy at that time.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things out of your control and the less physical aspects that were far more challenging, like very early days, still when you're in the matter, a couple of clots are discovered in your lungs, which, yeah, become more life-threatening.
Yeah.
Your business is struggling away. You get a call very early after your accident that a €1.2 million per annum contract is cancelled on you. Pretty brutal situation to have to deal with. And then you have your rehabilitation done when you're in the NRH, yeah, and you're lying there at night and you're left with your own thoughts.
Yeah.
That's the bit that you struggled with.
Yeah, yeah. An empty mind is a dangerous mind, and I tried to fill it up as best I could. And like, again, the pain was horrific. And like that, those lights would go off, I think it was 10 o'clock at night, and you put the curtain around you and you'd still could see a bit of glow from people washing their laptops, and you just knew everybody who was in there were pretty much in a bad way. And some nights you could hear people, like, you know, nearly talking to themselves. Some nights you could hear them, like, cries. And it was just, and I'm my biggest fear in life is being alone. And I felt very alone in those nights because I couldn't sleep with the pain. Because to this day, I'm still in 24/7 nerve pain, but then it was just horrifically sore pain. And the only way I was able to go to sleep was by tapping on the morphine drip or taking an extra OxyContin, which was, I'm not saying it was unlimited supply, but, you know, there was plenty of it that we could take because it was the only way you could cope. And then you'd knock it out and you'd fall asleep, and an hour later you're awake again because of the pain, because your feet are just on fire 24/7. And the thing was, when your feet were off the ground, that's when it was worse. And it still is to this day. When my feet are off the ground, the pain is way worse because that pressure is not on them, you know, to suppress that pain. And throughout the whole experience, it was, the nights were what I struggled with massively. I remember going to sleep at 7 o'clock in the morning after the whole night of fighting and trying to get to sleep. And then, like, you're meant to be down for breakfast at 8 o'clock, and you're being to go to sleep at 7 o'clock, and you're going, oh man, I have to go again. I have to get up and fight again, and put on that good face again, that, you know, you're all doing well. Because nobody time for a person who felt sorry for them. I could see that, you know, if you felt sorry for yourself in the inner age, you know, you could see people who weren't as happy to, you know, help you. Because, you know, why help somebody that's grumpy, angry with you, when you could be helping somebody who was there to work and improve? So you just had to put on that mask again and go again.
You mentioned the loneliness aspect of it, and it's probably not just loneliness, but you tell the story and you're very honest about it in the book, that part of those nights involves signing up to dating apps on the phone. You're obviously a married man at that point. When you analyse that, when you're actually putting it down on paper for this book, is it loneliness that's informing that, or are there a greater depth of emotions at play there?
I was straight, I don't fully understand it to this day. But it is something I've done. And I was never going to write a book and not have that in there, because ultimately that part of my recovery and that part of, I think, I was to, as a distraction. That's why I just think. Bear in mind, there's so much memory lapses from this time, from the drugs and all that type of stuff. I'm only thinking, not this, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not, you know, but I do think very early on, I also remember the people who loved me, still looked at me in pity now and talked to me in a different voice, because I was going through what I was going through. I was disabled and, you know, I was lying in bed and I was away from them in hospital and stuff like that. And that killed me inside, because it just did. I'm very proud, very independent. I was a bread provider. I was a supporter of a good few, you know, many staff.
You were a relatively traditional man.
Yeah, very traditional. No, not really, very traditional. Traditional. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, when people were looking at me in pity, and I just, I think I was just looking to speak to somebody who didn't know my position.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Because you're swiping people and they can see a certain amount, but they don't know your story.
Yeah.
And how far are these conversations going?
Oh, they're just one of the first conversations. I was this is the part that, you know, I was paralyzed from my belly button down. I was catheterized. I was, you know, nothing worked. I had no connection to my sexual organs. So how far could they go? But all I ever did was a conversation. That was it. Now, don't get me wrong, some of them were quite rude conversations.
Yeah.
But that's all they were.
Did anybody on the dating app find out about your situation?
Well, not during that time. Maybe now, since. I have no idea.
Right, fair enough.
Yeah, I don't know. Sorry for that. It's not something to be laughing about. But no, not at the time, no.
Yeah.
No.
You were going home every weekend at this point.
Yeah, almost every weekend.
Almost every weekend at this point.
Yeah.
At what stage does your wife find out?
Oh, it was in March, I think it was the week before St. Patrick's Day. Yeah, the weekend before St. Patrick's weekend. That was it. And ultimately, and even at this stage, I was at the weekends, I get home, and fair play to some friends and things like that. They took the pressure off Mandy, having to go up to Dublin, pick me up, bring me home and do the same thing. I had actually friends who came out of the woodwork, amazing people, pick me up in Dublin, in Dunleary, go all the way and bring me home to, you know, and they'd put the wheelchair in the back of the car. And they get me down to where we're now living, my grandmother's house, because we're building our dream house. So they'd get me home, and that weekend, I even in the house, I remember being, so I used to, it was only a two-bedroom house, my grandmother's house. I had three kids, a newborn baby, so Mandy, and so I'm going to go back a little bit more. Yeah. So Mandy had bought a mattress for me so that we could sleep in the same bed together. But unfortunately, the mattress that was bought was a disaster for me. Because when I went into it, I kept falling into it. I didn't even have the strength, even though it was only a little, I didn't have the physical strength to be able to get out of it. And I wasn't able to sleep in it. So yeah. I ended up going into the kids' room where there was like, you know, those double beds, and there's a single bed on top.
Yeah.
And I used to lie in the bottom of that. And the reason why I lied in the bottom, because you had the metal rings on top, so I could pull myself up and move myself. Even in there, when I couldn't sleep, I ended up talking to girls. And then ultimately, I went out to my yard, and I would bring the wheelchair out, go up this very steep ramp, and actually go into the office, do work the weekends, because I had to, you know, because the business was not a good place. And ultimately, when I was in the office one day, my phone was left there. Must have heard a text or something come through, and that's how I discovered it, you know.
The environment of being at home, that wasn't a linear return to normal life, so to speak.
No.
In fact, it probably presented a whole pile of different challenges for you, of course. Going through the rehabilitation program was an amazing success, and that day is obviously ecstatic for you, and I'm sure you have brilliant days at home. But you tell the very visceral story of how you're sitting in the house one day, and as you say, a traditional man, you see your father out putting a pillar into the ground outside.
Yeah.
And that triggers you in a bad way.
Yeah, look, things were extremely difficult at this stage. Yeah. I was a prisoner in my own house, ultimately, because, you know, the ramps weren't done properly in the house. I was still, even though I left NRH on my feet, that was more symbolic than anything else.
Yes.
If you know what I mean. I really wasn't walking. Yes, I walked into my car, but the physio and our system was either side of me. And at any stage, I could have just fell over. Thankfully, I didn't. But by God, you should have seen the fear in their faces, you know, as every step I took, you know. When I got home, I was a prisoner in my house, and there was a lot of silence in the house at the time too. And my fault as much as anybody else's, because I was a very different person. Very different person, which I didn't realise at the time. You don't when you're in it, you know. And I always remember I was there and on my own. Herself was obviously probably gone to work. The kids were either gone to the creche or gone to school. Can't really remember what it was. And my dad, lovely sunny day, and he went and started building a stone pillar to hang a gate. And I was in the sunroom, and I wasn't able to get up and, you know, and say hello to my dad. Never mind even help him. I wasn't even going to get up and say hello to him. And at that stage, I just said, because, you know, that pain is 24/7. But there's also something else going on. I started actually having gallbladder issues, which nobody realised what it was. So I was sometimes at night, I was absolutely crippled in pain on top of everything else. You know, and I was sick of it. There was other things going on as well, you know, in terms of what happened when I was in St. Finbar's with these uncontrollable convulsions. And, you know, so I thought this thing with the gallstone was something that is going to be just another thing of being a spinal cord injured person, and that I'd have to just put up with it. You know, there's all these things going on in my mind. But at that stage, I just said, you know, I give up this fight. I'm sick of it. My business has failed. My marriage has failed. My relationship with my kids is not great. You know, my body is still in a bad, bad way. And why keep fighting? I'm fighting, but I'm actually getting worse and worse and worse. Physically, I'm thriving, but everything else is just gone. Everything is gone. So I latched onto that physical thing, and like, I would go in with my Zimmer frame and go around the shopping centre, Joyce's shop in Athenry, and I'd be going around, and people coming up and said, "Aren't you doing mighty?" Because they see me on my feet. And, you know, they nearly tap me in the back and again talk to me in that pitchy tone. Again, they don't mean it. It's just a natural reaction. I'm a disabled person now at this stage. But the same people would have talked to me in complete and utter respect, you know, months earlier. And I used to be the one, "If you only bloody knew." But I'd go, "Oh, thanks very much."
Yeah.
And, you know, and then I'd get on that Zimmer frame and I'd get away from them as quick as possible.
Yes.
You know, so there's all that stuff going. And yeah, and I just said, "That's enough." And, you know, a good mate of mine, Stag, was on. I said I wasn't going to go, but I rang him up and I put on that mask. I said, "Willie, is there a bed down there?" "Of course there is." And I rang another guy who I knew was going, and went down to Limerick and absolutely made an absolute ass of myself. destroyed his stag, that to look after me and all that type of stuff. A lot of other things happened that night. And yeah, that was the start of me just giving up.
It does reach a new point after that as well, where you are right at the edge of giving up. And yeah. On two separate occasions, there's a moment in Dunleary and there's a moment in yeah. Galway as well.
Yeah, I will always put down the one moment in Dunleary as a more of a poor me.
Okay.
One. That's why I think it was.
Okay. Know? Whereas Galway was
oh yeah, it was the real deal.
Right.
Yeah. I was fully committed to that.
What's going through your head at that point in Galway?
Well, so when I obviously arrived in, I parked up the car down close to the fire station, and I again stumbled up through through Galway streets, you know, went to O'Brien's Bridge and looked in, and the tide was out, and I said, okay, tide is coming in. I can't swim, you know, I can go up and swim about 20 metres, but that's a fast running river. There's no way I was coming out of it. I jumped in and I said, okay, 2 hours that the tide will be in. And I walked back, I went down to a pub. I don't even know what the name of it is to this day. I can tell you where it is, I don't know what the name of it is. And I said to myself, I go in there for 2 pints, pub I'd never been into. I remember going into it, and as I went into it, I ordered a pint, and there was a group of students, you know, down the back, and they're having the crack. And for that 2 hours, I just looked to the ground. Just looked to the ground. Couldn't make eye contact with anybody. I had my 2 pints. I drank them very slowly. Nothing changed. I was, you know, maybe I was trying to give myself that time to talk myself out of it. I don't know, but nothing changed. And I basically went, got out of that pub, and I walked across the road. And I remember, again, so I wouldn't make eye contact with anybody. I think I was afraid of making eye contact with anybody. I think, because I think, you know, I'd lost that human connection that was seeking. And I kept my eye gaze, you know, where the footpath meets the building. That's where I kept my eye. And the next minute, out of the blue, this car pulled up on the left-hand side of me. And so we ran across the road, and next thing he stops me and kind of goes to me, "Gussie, what are you at?" And it was there I looked up, and it was Joe Brady, and I just grumbled.
Yeah. Hey, football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2 times the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18-plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8-6-25 and 1-5-26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpoints.tc.
Like, that man saved my life that day. Now, why did he know I was about to do it? Because obviously my parents and my sister had put out, you know, that alert for me, looking for me, saying that Fergus is in trouble, please look out for him. But I only found out a few months ago what happened. How did Gerard know about me going? And he said they'll drive around the patrol car. He's a detective in the police force, Gardaí. And he heard my name being mentioned over their radio, and he obviously went back and said, "Is that Fergus Farrell from Athlone Wright?" Because we had seen each other once on a train, I'd say a few years earlier, but we hadn't seen each other like 15 years. And he goes, "Yeah, he drove around all Galway beaches, all these different places looking for me. And 200 metres away from that bridge, not even 200 metres, he found me." Like, how close is that? How lucky is that?
Yeah.
You know?
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't thank that man enough, but I also can't thank my parents and my sister and whoever else was looking out for me. It was somebody who was looking out for me that day.
You are listening to Fergus Farrell talking about his book, Rebuilding a Man. I just want to take one quick break, and we'll wrap it up after these. You're welcome back. Fergus Farrell is in studio with me. Fergus, thanks so much for your honesty so far, and yeah. I'm sure it's not an easy conversation to have. I'm not sure, is this an easier conversation to have, or in many ways, is it because it's more recent, is it a harder conversation to have? But the attempt to row across the Atlantic.
Well, it's a lot easier.
A lot easier.
Yeah.
That was an amazing time in your life for a lot of it. When you get into the Gulf Stream, when you actually find your flow out in the Atlantic Ocean, you think to yourself, this is on. Obviously, there is a catalogue of reasons why your body reacts in the way that it does. Your blood pressure is alarmingly low. There is a situation where, as you mentioned earlier on, you had clots in your lungs after the accident and you were starting to feel that that was coming up again.
Yeah.
In terms of your own mentality after being taken away from that boat and after Damien rose the rest of the Atlantic on his own, how do you deal with that? What sort of emotions are there in terms of like regret or maybe, you know, sorrow towards Damien?
No. Talking now.
Yeah.
I have zero regret.
Okay.
Because now I see that as only an out and out win and success for myself. Because when I took on that challenge, I remember myself and Damo sitting down in the Huntsman, and he's saying to Gussie, Andrew can't do it. Would you do it with me? I was like, 100%. I went to the gym afterwards and I hopped on the rowing machine and I could row 5 minutes and I was out of breath.
Yeah.
Do you know? So that's where I was. And also I knew by taking on the challenge it was going to improve my physical, because I still was a poor walker. I still have a long way to go with my progress, and I still have. Every day is a day I'm improving. Like, it's crazy like how slow and minute there, you know, but there's still improvements, you know. I can still make improvements, but that whole journey and my physical improvements has been amazing for me. Like, you know, would I be where I am right now if I didn't take that on? I don't think so, non-physical wise. Do you know, and also the amount of people I met through it. Not many people have rowed into the Gulf Stream. You know, not many people have rowed around the Statue of Liberty numerous times, you know, for training. Not many people have rowed from New Jersey over to the Chelsea Pier. Not many people have rowed out through the out of New York at night, ready to hit for Galway. Not many people have got a chance to do a talk in the New York Athletic Club, you know. There's all these things now I look at and said, do you know something, that was my journey. All right, I didn't get to the outcome. I didn't get to the final point, which made me consider it a failure at the beginning. But now I look at it as a success for me, you know. And yeah.
What about in terms of your relationship with Damien? Was there a real sense of resentment towards you, did you feel, from Damien after you pulled out?
Resentment towards me?
Yeah.
I didn't know what to think while he was out in the ocean, because I did start, like, for a period of time I was sending him messages, and I knew though how difficult it was to reply to messages. A very slow, lumped process. But I did notice, you know, the further it went on, the lesser replies I was getting back. But I just put that down also as, you know, it's difficult out there, he's struggling. The last thing he wants to be doing is replying to a message from me. That's going to take him 15 minutes, which should on land take 5 seconds. So and then ultimately though, when he did come back, and I was very mixed emotion when he came back, because number one is he's after completing it, amazing achievement, but I'm here going, sugar, that could have been me, that should have been me, you know. And I had all these things, and I'm not good enough, and you know, these massive doubts come into your head and stuff like that, and I was in a bad place. And but then we sat down, we had the chat, and next thing he starts forgiving me. And I'm going, why are you forgiving me, Damo? You know, I'm not looking for forgiveness. Damo, it was me who left you out there, you know. Say, I should be saying sorry to you. But he started doing this when there was a camera on me, and I just did not like that. I did not like that at all. You know, do you know, I did not like that. That's something you say person to person in private, so you can have a proper chat about it. And that's just where it was, you know. And it just did not sit well with me at all.
He was talking about that moment, and as he says, the forgiveness as he comes into to Galway Bay.
Yeah.
When he questioned your mentality afterwards, did you think that was fair game?
Yeah. I did push myself as hard as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, you know, and this is all like in hindsight, you know, could I have prepared a little bit better? Maybe. But also there's a lot of things that could have been done a whole lot better on the other side of it as well. And I know 100% that I already reacted to, I reacted to a lot of things. You know, like I took on that role to do it with somebody, to train with somebody. That was taken away from me. And that wasn't my choice. I also did that role to raise awareness for spinal injuries, to raise awareness for mental health and all that type of stuff. And I found, unfortunately, that was very much buried within the whole project because it wasn't of value to it, which I found very... So basically, I went into the role for a certain reason. And ultimately, that role... it now wasn't what I went in for.
Mm-hmm.
And when it wasn't that way, I felt I probably didn't give as much as I needed to give it because it now wasn't something that I'd signed up for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know?
I see what you mean. You had your own vision of what this would represent and there was maybe a conflicting vision coming from the other side. And
yeah, and I was... My vision was because I was the one against two.
Yeah.
My vision was completely and utterly forgotten about, buried, not interested. Go on. You know, so,
yeah.
And that's fair enough. It wasn't my project.
Yes.
And that's the point is, I was midway, it wasn't my project.
We're pretty much completely out of time,
yeah,
Fergus.
Sorry.
But just one thing that I'm conscious of, if people have come to your story for the very first time today and they're listening to this on the radio, I should illustrate the point that you've walked into the studio, you're going to walk out of the studio, your rehabilitation was an unbelievable success in that context. Does your rehabilitation continue now or do you just train with regards to upkeep of the body?
So... If I stop training, if I stop doing things, I start losing my balance more. I start actually sinking. Mm-hmm. I get lower. I fall over things more, and so on, so on. So, fitness is going to be part of everything I do.
Okay.
And again, I don't mind if you mind me mentioning.
Of course.
So, I made a pledge to myself after coming off that road that anything I'm going to do, I'm going to make sure I'm true to myself. You know, and I was always looking for my next project to do. And I have that now done. And my next project, I'm walking across America. And why am I doing walking? Because I can do it. And most people can. But there's people out there who can't and only wish they could. And I'm doing this new Brooklyn Bridge to San Monaco Pier, 4,500 kilometres, hoping to do 60 kilometres a day, 75 days in a row. And the reason being is I'm going to be going through towns and roads and whatever where people with disabilities can come and join me and be part of the journey rather than being this extreme thing going up a mountain that only superhuman beings can do and all these, you know, or even crossing an ocean. Do you know what I mean? I'm trying to do something that, you know, people can be part of me and part of who I am now rather than trying to be this superhuman being that I'm not.
When are you hoping to do this?
I'm starting in August 2026 and,
right.
And I hope, you know, it's been launched in January.
Yes.
With Spinal Injuries in Ireland. They're my partners in it. Fantastic organisation, and I just like, you know, and I hope to raise awareness around spinal injuries, raise money for spinal injuries, and that's my next path, that's my next journey.
You're a man who thrives when he has a challenge in front of him.
Yeah.
So am I right to conclude that you're doing well now? You've illustrated just the incredible amount of drugs that you're putting into your body at the early stages of rehabilitation. That's been turned down now. You feeling better as a consequence?
Yeah, well, I'm still on 16 tablets a day.
Okay, right.
And that's
so not turned down that much?
No, but the addictive ones are gone.
They're gone.
I'm on gabapentin, Sanaflex, those type of tablets, which are nerve repressants, basically. They still have the side effects, but nothing comparison. So, yeah, look, my where am I now? Absolutely fantastic. I'm walking the wild Atlantic Way, training for America. And I tell you this much, it is a joy. Like it's 2,500 kilometres. I'm doing it over 10 stages, 5 days every month. And I tell you this much, it's one of the nicest things I've ever done. I'm doing it on myself. Now, I have been joined on occasion by people, some amazing people. But it's one of the most enjoyable things I've taken on because it is me, it's the earth, it's just a challenge. And it's tiring. But it's enjoyable.
It certainly is. I must say, Fergus, Rebuilding a Man is an absolutely sensational read. I'd highly recommend it. I've only scratched the surface in terms of some of the things that I'd like to ask you about, but I'm sure we'll get you back on again in the new year when you're promoting this this walk, and there's a few more things I'd like to ask you, because it's been an amazing journey. Congratulations on everything to date, Fergus, and very best of luck with everything.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Rugby on Off the Ball
with Bank of Ireland, a proud sponsor of Connacht, Leinster, Munster and Ulster Rugby. Never stop competing.
Hey football fans, Drew Brees here. Kroger Play and Owner's Box have teamed up for the next generation of daily fantasy sports. First-time players can get $25 in free entries, plus 250 fuel points. And you can score all season long with 2x the fuel points for every dollar spent to use at Kroger Fuel Centers. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
Void where prohibited. Eligibility restrictions apply. 18 plus in most eligible states, but age varies by jurisdiction. Offer is valid between 8/6/25 and 1/5/26. Terms apply. See full terms and conditions at ownersbox.com/footballfuelpointstc.